Sarah, what's up?
Kevin, what's up?
How you
How's it
doing?
going?
It's going good. I'm losing my voice.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that's fun. I feel fine though.
Were you yelling at the Phillies last night in the NLCS or
No, I was not.
Niners in
I
Monday
watched
night?
the Niners game. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
That
But
was a rough one.
unrelated, yeah. To start it off, you just got back from the lobby conference, right?
I did. I think we talked about that in a prior episode as like one of the
Yeah.
only conferences I will go to as a founder.
So explain to people like what it is and like why is that one of the only events that you go to, and also how do you get invited to that as well, maybe?
So first of all, one of the things that makes it so great is it's entirely off the record. Now I can
Yeah.
talk about I attended the lobby
Of course.
conference. But you have these sessions where it's really participatory. So it's not just like someone talking at you.
Right.
And everything said in the session is off the record and confidential. So, you can learn a lot, and people are really authentic, I think, in a way that you don't normally get when you get a bunch of founders and VCs in a room.
Oh, yeah.
And the sessions are on everything from like business topics to I went on one about balancing, work and family.
Right.
So it's just really incredible people talking in a really authentic way in Hawaii, which
In Hawaii
also
is a
helped.
draw as well. Yeah. Yeah, I've been to it before as well. It was a good conference. I still find it hard. How long did you go for?
So I actually stayed an extra day because this time I took my whole family.
Yeah.
So shout out to David Hornick, who runs the conference with
Yes.
Lobby Capital, great VC firm if you're looking for investment, plugging
Yes.
them. And I think it's one of the reasons I go to this above all the other millions of conferences is like I can bring my family,
Right,
and
right.
I haven't every year. This is actually only the second time I've brought them, but I love that it's a kind of family-friendly event that supports founders and other operators in their entirety. You can really bring your whole self to the conference.
Right. Yeah, and also the off the record, are people really off the record? Like no holds barred? Do you think? Obviously, Twitter people are putting out what they want you to hear. In this, do you find that people really tell you the honest truth?
I mean, I think so. Like, I don't know for sure if it's the truth or not, but the amount of information people are willing to share certainly seems like a level or two deeper than you're not getting in kind of these conversations that,
Yeah.
someone has prepared a speech, for example. So I have definitely found that I get insight into the market a lot more than like what a VC will tell you.
Right.
You pitch a VC and they're like, oh, sorry, it's too early.
Yeah.
But you may
Yeah.
actually learn off the record that that VC doesn't have a fund anymore that they can
Right,
invest.
right, right.
And so you kind of start, things start to click in a way that, of course, you don't know if anything's ever 100% true, but I
Yeah.
definitely have felt like people are really willing to share more than they would share in other forums.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. When I went there, it was amazing. I don't know why I haven't. I have a hard time pulling myself out of the business and taking vacation. Even if it is to go on with a bunch of founders and VCs, I definitely should more. But I don't know. Things are working here, and I don't know. I'm just the type of person that can only concentrate on one thing, and it's just like in the business every single day. I know it's not healthy. Definitely don't have work-life balance. I go home at a reasonable hour, and I spend the weekend with my kids and my wife. But outside of that, it's just like work, work, work. Vacations typically don't happen that often for me. But I definitely
You
highly
don't like
recommend to go to this
vacations
conference.
where I'm like sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah,
So this is like a
yeah.
good mix for me of like being in a beautiful location where you're
Right.
feeling relaxed, but you're actually like the kind of insights I'm getting and the things that just start clicking in my head when I'm around people that are kind of sharing at this level. It's definitely helpful for my business.
Right,
So I don't feel bad like I'm taking away
right.
company.
Right. So we had a few topics on the dog for today. Did you want to start anywhere in particular?
I think, you know, one thing, especially coming back from this conference where it was a lot of what people cared about. And I think, you know, I just read in the news today about more ridiculous valuations for AI companies.
Yeah.
I definitely wanted to hit on how, you know, we're thinking about AI at Winnie, how founders who are not building AI companies should be thinking about AI.
Yeah.
And what it also means for like the fundraising landscape.
Right. So you sent me an article and information. It was around a supplier of, I guess it was just GPUs, right? They were just like they weren't a manufacturer, but they were just like providing GPUs to AI companies to use. And
yeah,
they got this like ridiculous valuation. I think, what was it? 100 times revenue or something like that.
Yeah. And not only that, so the companies together.
Together.
And it is, I'm just reading, they sell access to cloud-based servers running on NVIDIA's AI chips, as well as software that helps startups train and run AI models.
Got it.
So it's definitely an AI infra company. And I think what was so, you know, wild is like they just raised and then they immediately, like we're not talking 6 months later, just like immediately raised more at a higher valuation from the investors who were unable to get in at their lower round. And so I think it's just showing like there is just so much interest in and so much money going to AI companies that I think, you know, founders of non-AI companies might be wondering like, what should we be doing here? Can we access any of this money by turning ourselves into an AI company? Should we be doing that?
I think don't do that.
That's like, I think what a lot of folks are wondering. And I am seeing like founders reposition their entire business as AI to try to access some of this funding, because there really is no funding for growth stage companies otherwise.
There isn't, which is really sad, because we're in a place that funding has, interest rates are high. So funding overall has dropped. People are putting their money in other investments outside of venture. So even there's a lot of VC firms that are going under. There's a lot of VC firms that are not able to actually raise the full fund that they were wanting to. There's a lot of VC firms that are firing partners because they just don't have the capital. And so that obviously trickles down. That means more, that means less money for just VC in general. And then you have this big wave of like, this is going to be the current hype cycle, which is AI. It was crypto before, or Web3 or whatever previously. And previously when I was building my last company, it was on-demand startups and everything. And everybody thinks that they just need to get in one, right? Like this is how the VCs make their money off of the one in a 20 companies or so that are all battling it out, and one just kind of takes off and they make a 100x return. And that's what VCs, that's how they actually return capital to their investors. And so they're all chasing these companies that they may, from the outside, it does look silly, and it is silly. And if you're a founder taking this money, it is very unhealthy, and you most likely are going to lose. But from the VC side of things, it actually may be like more practical, because you can only lose 1x your money. But on some of these outcomes, if you bet on the right one, right? Like if you bet on OpenAI, I think they're selling secondary at $90 billion. Like if you bet on OpenAI, it's crazy. You would have made so that would have returned your fund like 10 or 20 times over if you got in relatively, not even relatively early, but like maybe in Series B or whatever, wherever they raise money. And so it's logical for the investors to make a lot of different bets, but they don't need any, like any individual one to pay off. But from a founder's perspective, like if people are continuing to throw money at you, for one, it's hard to turn it down, because you look and it's like, wow, I have all these competitors. Money's going to solve all my problems. It really doesn't. And it just creates, in my opinion, a lot more problems. Unless you know exactly what you're doing, and you know this is the capital that you need. But we've seen this so many times before. I think it also creates just like really top heavy companies. Like you look at like the Ubers of the world, like right. How much more efficient would they have been if they actually didn't have so much competition and didn't have so much VC money pouring into the ride sharing space and food delivery space. They don't need to have that many people, but everybody was like funding their competitor, and the Uber at the time felt they had to raise so much money as a war chest. Then they just hired so many people, which you're going to if you have that capital, and then you're just so top heavy. And what should be actually very capital efficient, they're a marketplace. They make 20% to 30% margins on every single ride. They should have been profitable a long time ago. But you have this thing that VC money, it just, and then you had the tigers of the world that just came in with crypto and all of this stuff. And it just, it's really messy, but it actually makes logical sense to me from a VC perspective. But from a founder's perspective, I think it's absolute, like, do not follow anybody, for one. Like,
okay, I actually disagree with this.
Okay, go for it.
So I think as a founder, if you are trying to raise money, you should really be thinking about how AI is going to make your product 100x, 1000x better than anything that's been attempted before. And that should be part of your pitch. I think you would be foolish not to incorporate AI in your pitch, at least, because there is such a valuation difference for businesses that incorporate AI. It's just the math. Like, you are just not going to get funded as a non-AI company. So yeah, it's different if you're not raising.
Yeah.
Worry about this or pay attention to it. But if you, in terms of incorporating it into your pitch, I do think there's stuff you should be doing with AI. But if you are raising, your pitch should be AI focused, because every investor is thinking about this right now. And so if you are missing it and it's not part of your pitch, you're just speaking a different language than what they're looking to fund. So I think that is a big, like, just mistake that you're going to be making if you go out and raise and AI is not a central focus of your pitch.
I completely disagree. I think that it definitely should be included in like the potential future on how you can use a lot of these AI services, just like you can use a lot of the other services that were created around us, right? Like AWS and like machine learning and all these different things. But like, I don't think that you should pivot your business on AI.
That is how you actually should run your business. So if you are not going out and raising,
yeah,
how should you be thinking about AI? You should be thinking about how you can leverage the services or the tools that are out there that are using AI, or leverage AI that's easy to incorporate into your business to make your business a lot better, faster, stronger, bigger, all those things. But you should not be building the rails or the infrastructure for AI, because there are companies that are explicitly focused on just that, and they are going to leapfrog you, and you will be able to access those tools and technology. So you should not be building anything that's like at the infra level, but yeah, you should be taking advantage of the technology as it comes out to make your business better, because your competitors are going to. And so if you're not, you're going to fall behind. But I think that's different from if you are pitching. Your pitch should really, really include not just like, hey, I'm going to use a few of these AI tools that are out there, but like, actually, this problem that you might have heard about in the past is now going to be solved in a fundamentally different way using AI.
Yeah.
And we're the ones to do it. And then, you know, you decide if you actually want to build your business that way. But I do think if you're not pitching it that way, you're making a huge mistake, because that is all investors are thinking about right now.
That definitely is what most investors are thinking about. But I think that there are so many investors also that are anti-AI. Now, those investors may have a hard time. I know some growth stage fund or growth stage companies that are getting funded right now. So I wouldn't say that there's zero being funded. I also do think that if you go up against an investor and you kind of pitch that AI is going to be your focus, and it's really, it doesn't make any sense, they're going to think you're stupid. And they're just going to be like, you're just trying to bolt on this thing. Doesn't make any sense. I'm like, you don't have any credibility.
I don't know that investors are that savvy.
I think they are. They definitely are. Okay, so let's do this example. How, Sarah, for Winnie, how would you kind of pitch right now? I know that you're not raising money, but like, yeah. How would you incorporate it?
Yeah, I was thinking about this because, you know, childcare is probably one of the last industries you would imagine getting disrupted by AI. Like, it is, unlike education, like ed tech, there's plenty of stuff. But when it comes to like early education and childcare, like physical humans still need to be in the mix.
Yes.
So first, like how I'm actually leveraging AI in the business to make Winnie a lot stronger. Our business is incredibly data heavy. Like we collect all this proprietary information about daycares and preschools that you can't find anywhere else. So we are actually using AI in the back end to help with a lot of that data collection, a lot of the data cleaning, a lot of the proprietary data. That all was incredibly manual and incredibly time consuming. And we can do that so much faster with AI. Like, I'll give you one example. Like, we can feed a bunch of like poorly formatted addresses into ChatGPT and like in, you know, seconds get back all the correct formatting and like find out what addresses are actually like not going to geocode. And like, that was something that was incredibly time consuming to figure out before. You'd have to write some kind of regex and then it would always get some things wrong. And like, that is the kind of thing that like AI is really good at. So those sorts of things just make operations like so much more efficient on the data side of things, which powers our whole business. But if I were going into a pitch with investors, I would certainly talk about that. But I might talk also about the user experience for searching for childcare and how that's going to fundamentally change with AI, how people are going to, you know, think about their search differently instead of, you know, typing into a search box their location and then using all these filters. You know, they may just want to tell you about their situation and then have you figure out some recommendations based on the proprietary data you have. Now, are we building all of that right now? No, because I think there will be more tools and technology we can just take advantage and build on top of. And our focus should be our proprietary data set at the moment. But if I were going out and pitching, I would probably talk about that future vision, even if I weren't building a brand new search experience and a brand new marketplace experience quite yet.
Yeah, I guess including it in future stuff or improving everything. But like, I don't know, if I'm a smart VC, and VCs are like, the good ones are smart. They are. And they recognize when like you're bullshitting them. And it's just like those two things that you just recommend. So like for you, so we also deal a lot with addresses. Like, there's companies that do this and like they're not AI powered. And they do this for free, and we use them as well. So like AI to get the correct addresses, like we have a service that we use, and it doesn't cost anything. It has nothing to do with AI. So I think that it's just like, it's, to me, it's just, it's not totally honest. And I think that I don't know. It just doesn't feel right to me. And I also would not want to get funded, especially with somebody like you were talking to a lead investor that like you pitch them based on this AI vision and like none of this works. Like, in reality, it may increase your productivity. Like, we use AI within the company today. Like, we use AI to like for our sales team and to summarize like transcripts and like a lot in our marketing and like creating like copy and like all that stuff. Like, the traditional we use all of these tools, but like, we're not today an AI company. I think we potentially can be, like, use AI machine learning for some predictions for inventory levels and everything down in the future. But it's just such a small thing that I think that like what happens in these hype cycles is that typically everybody thinks that it's going to change everything. And like, sometimes it, like, mobile did, obviously. I think that AI, honestly, for everyday businesses is going to make us maybe 10 or 20% more like productive. I think that the winners are going to be the infrastructure layers on top of everything else. Everybody else will just use these things as tools. That's why it just doesn't make sense to me that how you kind of craft a pitch around AI when like you're solving a real problem for your customers And it just doesn't feel honest to me.
I mean, I think it is worth doing your research on who you're pitching. I think a lot of investors are putting out the, like, I just read a blog post from NFX, and they have a whole AI vision for marketplaces. And they have a very clear thesis that, like, if you're not thinking about AI totally fundamentally changing your marketplace, like, you're completely wrong and they'll never invest in you is basically what the blog post said. And they had kind of like different levels of how to think about AI. The most basic being like using it to improve your operations. They're like, yeah, duh, everyone's doing that. You got to do that. But then there's like three more levels. And then specifically for marketplaces, like how they see the world. So a lot of investors put their thesis out there. And I think what you would find if you look at the thesis of many investors is they don't think AI is going to be a 10 or 20% improvement. They think it's going to be, you know, a much, much bigger shift, even in a greater way than mobile was. Like, I think if you just, some don't, and some are still doing the, you know, more traditional investments, but I think a lot of them are seeing this as the future, and they are, you know, they didn't see that with Web3 or crypto or some of these other things. So,
well,
I think
definitely some did. Let's be real.
Some of those are now out of business.
Let's even just talk about Andreessen Horowitz. Like, how much did they put into for crypto? That they basically turned their entire firm into like a crypto. Well, they have a separate crypto fund, but like that's all they focused on.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's why it is important to know who your audience is, because if you were pitching Andreessen Horowitz at the time and you didn't have a crypto thesis, like it would have been much, much harder to get funded, I think. And, you know, not saying that you need to get funded by them or that that's actually good for your business. I know a lot of businesses that received a lot of funding from Andreessen Horowitz and are out of business today for that reason, or had to totally pivot down to nothing. Like, look at Clubhouse. That was like the huge bet for Andreessen Horowitz, and now they're kind of rebuilding from nothing. I think that is not necessarily what you should do, but if your desired outcome is to raise money, you should really take a hard look at the thesis of the investors you're raising from, and make sure if they're one of these investors, which I think a lot are, that believe that AI is going to fundamentally change everything, you better have a pitch. Or just don't pitch them. Like, it's just going to waste your time if you aren't really thinking about that and talking about that as part of your pitch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely very, you definitely need to pitch the right audience. And also there's something to be said, like, if you are looking to raise a round, right? Like, investors, they do invest a lot out of FOMO. So like, if you can go and get like your first job as when you're going out and raising money is getting that very first term sheet. So do whatever you can to do that. If that means going and pitching some AI vision of whatever, and then you get a term sheet from that, then you leverage that to go to other VCs and be like, I have a term sheet and here are the terms. And then you go and try to get more term sheets. And then I would say that the VC that you pick, especially if they're the lead investor going to be on your board, you want to have them really understand your business. I have made that mistake before, and I would say that it probably cost me the last business to have like a reasonable outcome. Like, I went for, and I rode the hype cycle with my last company, Ship, and like looking at the people that we brought in, it was really like, it was based on that the on-demand economy was going to change everything, and everything was going to be, it was Mark Andreessen's famous like memo, the phone is the remote control for the real world. It turned out not to be the case for most industries. There's only a few industries that actually was true. And so I took on investors thinking that we were going to be the next Uber, which we definitely were not. And that really hurt me, like trying to pivot into certain other areas and all of this. And we were not growing as fast as we can. And then that just makes everything. So when we raised so much money, we hired all these executives, like we couldn't pivot, we couldn't move. It really like kind of pigeonholes you into like what you sold them. So I definitely would recommend that whoever you like, do anything you can to get like the most fair valuation for yourself. I'm a big believer, take as little money as you possibly can to get to the next stage of your business. And that's going from me doing the opposite of my last company. I know a lot of people think the opposite. And it's like, take as much money as you can, as high valuation as you can, and then you'll just have money to figure it out. I think that creates a lot of bad habits. I think that you are pressured to spend the money. I think you're going to hire seasoned executives, and especially before you found product market fit. I think that is like a really, really easy way to die. I think a lot of people would say like either choosing the wrong co-founder or prematurely scaling before product market fit are like the top two reasons that startups fail. And so you really want to be aligned with the investors that you actually do take capital from. But I do agree with you, like your job as CEO, founder is to like get as many terms sheets as you can. Yeah, go pitch the AI vision. That makes sense. But I also do think that there's so many investors out there, and there's so many ones that have theses that there's a lot in my space that are going after logistics tech, and like those are the ones that I want to work with.
Right.
And they completely ignore AI. Now, are they writing the checks at the same pace? No, they're definitely not. And that's why it's like, we're like, even both of us, we're in this mode of like going to profitability. You're profitable right now. We're on that journey as well. And we're waiting for the market. I'm personally waiting for the market to turn around. We have very strong product market fit, but I'm just not going to go to the market for a large growth round until it turns around. It's just, it'd be a bloodbath to go in right now and try to raise, even with the metrics that we have. So it's an interesting time.
I think on top of that, you don't know which VCs actually have money to invest right now. I think that is still settling out. Like you were saying, we're seeing firms shut down. We're seeing firms shrink because maybe they're investing out of their last fund, but they haven't yet raised the new fund.
Yes.
And so you may end up pitching a lot of folks that can't actually fund you no matter what your metrics are, even though they seem like they're still active and like, of course they're raising their next fund, but let's see if they actually do. As long as interest rates remain high, that may be increasingly unlikely. I'd also just advise anyone who is raising to ask the person you're raising from the last investment they did.
Yes.
Or the last five investments they did, if those were
or even more like how many, whatever stage you're at, Series A, Series B or whatever, many of those checks has your firm written in the last quarter?
Right.
And that really should, like, they're not going to lie to you.
VCs, I think, will be honest about that. Like, they may, they haven't written checks. They may say, we looked at a bunch of companies. But, like, they're basically saying, no, we have not written any checks. They booked a company.
Yeah.
They're telling you the answer. So you have to listen to what they're saying. And if the answer isn't, here's the press release of the last company we funded.
Right.
Then it's a no. They did not invest. And like, you have to, and then, okay, well, when was it? Was it a year ago? Out of which fund was that? Is that fund still have capital left to invest? And like, actually ask these questions. They should be either willing to tell you, or if they're kind of bullshitting around the answer, they haven't.
They definitely should. And they probably will say, if they're not writing checks, they'll be like, no, we were on pause and now we're actively looking or something like that. But you can read between the lines and be like, why are you so special? Unless you have just outrageous metrics and like anybody's going to invest in you, which would be like, if you're growing 500 to 600% year over year, that would be like, and you're profitable or something crazy. Like, and those two things, like that would be like, you could get funded by anybody basically if you had those metrics. But like, if you're growing at like 100 or 200% year over year, it's tough out there if you are a non-AI company. It's a tough time out there for founders. But kind of pivoting into our next topic that applies to both of us. So we're both kind of in like, we're not hiring anybody else right now. On our journey to get profitable, setting ourselves up for growth rounds when the market turns around. How do you, but what that means is that we're not going to be growing at as a traditional like venture backed business because we're not hiring more people, right? Like we're a sales led organization, and if you don't hire more sales or marketing people, like you're just not going to grow at the venture scale. So how do you think? And I think this is kind of similar to what you guys are doing as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an area where you can actually really use AI, like in a legit way, not in a pitch way. Like, what is the thing that's limiting your business? Like, is it SDR outreach on the sales side? Like, could you use AI to do a bunch of that outreach? I'm seeing lots of companies that are doing that now. I think even down to like phone voice technology that sounds like a real person, or like automating kind of chat flows that feel like they're, you know, using that to feel like it's a real customer service or salesperson that can then lead to a real person once you have a warm lead.
Right.
Or is it like, you know, the actual real salesperson? So not the SDR, not that outreach, but like the actual salesperson. Can you make your salespeople more efficient by helping them create great proposals using AI that feel really custom? And, you know, we're using AI to like create decks that like wouldn't have been possible for a salesperson to create without like marketing and design. And now, you know, they can do some of that themselves. So I feel like this is actually where AI could be useful. Now, the technology may not be caught up to what your needs are. And what you don't want to do then is like, oh, I need a great deck making software. I'm going to now start working on generative AI to create images. And like, no, just wait for that to become available and someone else to make that. But I think this is where like I am seeing the capabilities kind of get better and better every day. So devoting some of your time to like, okay, what is limiting the business that we don't have headcount for? And can we kind of get there or get part of the way there with AI?
Sure. But thinking about like your road to $1 billion in revenue, like you're not going to be able to just automate a lot of these things with AI and all these different things.
Not a billion in revenue.
No.
Maybe.
But so, but thinking about that, right? Like, When you are focused on profitability, which I think a lot of companies are right now, I hear a lot of companies that are either cash flow positive, they're profitable, but their growth rates are way down. So they're either not growing, they're growing at 25% year over year, all of those things. To get the VC cycle, you're going to have to increase your growth rate very dramatically. So have you thought at all about that? I don't know if that like, or even just like timing, like I'm hoping the market picks up next year. That's what I'm hearing. And so that's what I'm kind of going off of. And so do you just kind of wait it out and do what you can do? But I think that it is a really big change, just like it was a change from like, you use venture to just grow and hire the team and all this. And then you're like, no, we have to probably do layoffs and we have to get profitable and all that. How do you like restart that engine to, if you want to, right? It could also be your choice. You just want to be profitable and you're looking for maybe an exit that is not going to be that you're not going to get to $1 billion in revenue and all that. But I think that like on the podcast here, it's like we're talking about VC backed startups. So we obviously, hopefully everybody wants to get to that range. And
we're not
going
to get to $1 billion of revenue. I think $1 billion. There's very few companies that generate $1 billion of revenue. But we like to think about like 100 million in revenue, because I think that having that clear path to 100 million is like what is needed. For example, in raising a Series B, you want to be like at 10 million in ARR and you want to have that clear story to 100 million. Now, in this market, you might have to be beyond 10 million ARR. If you're not an AI company, so I'm not saying you can necessarily raise with that, but I think those have been kind of the standard Series B metrics. So we don't think about $1 billion because that hurts my small brain, but I can think about 100 million.
Hey, if you do 100 million, the next is $1 billion. You're in a massive market.
So I think the big question, and this is also a question we will be asked when we're raising our Series B, is are we getting there on our current business?
Yeah.
And just growing the levers, and do we understand those levers? or do we have to add like a new business line or go into a new area? And I think that's what, you know, you have to answer for yourself. If it's a matter of like, it's a lever thing and we understand the levers and we just have to grow them, and actually having a cash infusion helps because it allows us to hire 10 more salespeople and this many more things and it payback is this, like, then it's really easy. You can just do that in advance of a fundraise, or you can, even if you understand your business enough, explain that in a fundraise. If it's a fundamentally new business line, like actually this one, it only gets to 50 million reasonably, and we need another one to get to 50 million. That is where I think it's going to be really hard to go back into that growth mode, because you haven't even invested in understanding that new business line.
Yep.
And so I think that is like definitely a challenge for us as a childcare marketplace. There, we always get questions about our TAM. Like, can this, like, I see this business works really well at, you know, 10 million ARR, but can you get it to 100 million? Is there enough, you know, you're telling me it's a $60 billion market in the US, but is there enough in what you do, which is like kind of the advertising side of this, to get to 100 million in revenue?
Right.
And I think historically that's where our pitch has always been challenging. If we had another business line, we said like, okay, we're doing this, but then we also sell them this other thing.
Yeah.
And we have some proof points that we can upsell to that. And that one you can see grows to 200 million. And even though it's only at 1 million ARR today, like, it's going to be the combination of these two. Like, that is, I think, where we would have a much stronger pitch, and we're not investing in kind of that second business today. And I think that's the case for a lot of companies, where like that second business line gives them the really compelling pitch, and they can't afford to make that investment. Right. Or not necessarily like a totally different business line, but it's like the addition to the current business line that makes it feel really big.
Right. Right. No, that makes sense. And just for people listening, I think that for Series A really is about like, you've had some product fit and you're looking to start to create a sustainable go-to-market strategy. So if you are an enterprise company, it's, can you hire a few SDRs, a few AEs? Can you actually get enough opportunities for marketing to, and then close them out and actually onboard them? And then can you, to go to a Series B would be, can you actually, have you proven that out in Series A? Do all the things, like, that's where it's like, yeah, what is your CAC? What is your payback? Like, how many times are you doing this? Are you doing this regularly enough? Is a capital infusion, meaning adding more SDRs, AEs, more marketing, more investment in brand, all of those different things, is that going to get you to the next step? I think that's what you need to think through. On the consumer is obviously a little different, and it's got to be mostly driven by viral growth. It just has to be. Or you just have like ridiculous, and actually, well, yeah, like something like a Chat GPT, right? And there's just viral growth that's happened to them mostly, and they don't have any cost to acquire these customers. So you definitely need to show that's continuing to kind of grow in a way. I think consumer is super, super hard to raise a Series B on. And
that's why everything that starts to consumer like pivots to enterprise or, you know, B2B in some way.
Yeah, that's with me. Yeah, Shipp was a consumer business, and we were pivoting towards SMB, which is a terrible market to be in. And then now at Airhouse, it really is. We serve smaller brands, but the goal is to continue to go out market and make millions of dollars per customer net revenue eventually. And so for us, it's really showing that we can we can add more people, we can add more products, differentiate ourselves. We can add on additional lines of business to get more money out of our existing customers, and all of those different things. And I just the reason I asked the question is like, everybody's focused right now on just kind of staying alive. And I think that's what I wasn't building startups in the 2000s, but I think that there was very few companies that kind of made it out alive. And it was just kind of if you got out of that and you were still alive, like you kind of also, you didn't have a lot of competition as well. So I think that I'm thinking through this right now because I'm just like, we're so focused on just on profitability and obviously like reducing churn and but we're not like super growth mindset. And I think that that's going to also, when the market changes again with these traditional businesses that are not AI, I think it's going to be tough to kind of switch your teams over to that mindset as far as like, we're going to be hiring a lot more people again. And I'm just curious. I mean, I was just thinking about how we're going to do this. If we are able to raise a really good B next year, myself, and that's why I kind of posed the question.
I mean, you hit on something, which is kind of what we're doing to still have this sort of growth mindset and be thinking about kind of the next phase, which is we are selling to existing customers and we are trialing some of these other areas with existing customers. And so like, we will only build it and do the trial if we can sell it to them.
Yeah.
And then we're looking at the trial as like, okay, we'll cut them a really good deal on this other thing that we want to do. So we kind of cover some of our costs, but really we're doing this as like an R&D effort. And we're upfront with our customers about that, that like, look, we have our core business. You're doing that with us. We're super happy to serve you there. Like we expect that to always be like super strong and we're going to retain you 100% there.
Yeah.
But we want to try this other thing with you. We're going to do it with you at a low cost because we're also learning. It may not be that great. Like we are not promising to deliver the same quality that we do for our core business, but are you willing to try it? And if we've hit on something, like for us, that other thing is helping daycares and preschools hire staff.
Right.
So be like an Indeed competitor for them. And they are so desperate for solutions for that, that they're like, yeah, okay, we'll try it. We know we're getting a deal. And we also know it may not be as good as like the core thing we're doing with you, which is, you know, finding parent leads. And we've had some success there and we've built out a lot of our hiring stuff because we've kind of been testing it with these set of customers. And now I do feel like if we ever do go out and fundraise, we would start to be able to tell that story of like, here's the second business line. Here's how it's ramping up. Here's how we could throw money at it to grow it faster, which we're not doing. So I think, you know, as much as possible, like if there are customers you can do it with, you kind of kill two birds with one stone there.
Yeah, that strategy kind of reminds me, I don't know why this popped into my head, and I'm sure there's better examples, but AngelList strategy. So how AngelList started out as a marketplace for startups and investors, and they just were a matchmaking service. I don't think they took anything from investors at all. And they were just a place. And then they added on, and I'm probably going to get the order in which they launched their products out. But then they added on a job. Once they got so many startups on, they added on a jobs for startups there. And then they launched tools for investors to create their own SPVs.
Yep.
And now they're also getting into banking for startups and everything. So they're trying to kind of be this whole platform around powering startups and investors at the same time. But you could kind of see how they're continuing to layer on all of these different products. And theoretically, they're probably doing, and they have the startups or the investors already on, and they're adding additional products, that it's just going to increase the value for that that customer to them. And I think they've done a pretty good job of that.
I'd like to have a word with AngelList, though. Whoever manages their marketing and their brand, like they are splitting their brand equity in such a major way. Like they renamed their whole jobs product to Wellfound. AngelList, like questionable whether that's actually the right brand, but they should pick one brand. If they really want to be this umbrella for startups and funds, they should pick one brand. They should build everything under that brand and not split. Like brand is everything when it comes to, you know, this kind of market. Like I just don't understand their strategy there.
I didn't know that they renamed it, but I definitely know that they've been pretty good on the on the hiring side of things. We definitely hired a lot of people out of
we AngelList. Hired a lot of people, and they're also free to list your jobs, which is great.
Yes.
They're like they were kind of building this like almost crowdfunding tool where you could basically, you know, raise money through AngelList through an SPV that someone created on AngelList.
Yep.
So kind of crowdfunding, kind of like an SPV tool. And then I feel like they just kind of like gave up that market. Like they just they're missing something on the branding and marketing.
Yeah.
I feel like they could have owned so much more. Like they were first to all these things.
Yeah.
And then I think they also don't they own Product Hunt?
Yep.
And like again, splitting the brand, like just pick one brand, own all these pieces under one roof, like market them well.
Yeah.
They could be doing so much more. I don't understand what they're why they're, you know, where they're at still. Like I feel like they could have been a public company. They could have been doing like Carta stuff. Like
They are now.
Yeah. I feel like they whiffed on all of these opportunities that could have been like theirs and solely theirs.
Well, I think this is also like the I think there's a lot of people that say that first to market is like you have a leg up on the competition, but I'd actually argue that's not the case in most cases, unless you have just something that is just network effects driven and it's just like first to market and it's just like, this is the product. But what happens is you have people like AngelList that they've done all this work and then you have somebody else that comes in and is like, oh, this is an interesting like idea. And now we're only going to do this and we're going to do this way better because this is our sole focus. This is exactly what I'm doing. Like we're not definitely for like, we are in such a crowded market. We're doing this completely different than anybody else has ever done it before. And so I think that the first mover advantage is actually way overplayed. And it's usually like the third or fourth into the market that typically does win. Obviously there's exceptions to every rule. But it is like, You have a company that's doing a lot of stuff and it's just like you pick out like a good example, Slack. Like Slack was not the first like chat messenger. I think HipChat was or something like that. And then that was a side project from Atlassian, wasn't it? And they just like Slack is just like they just focus just on that. And I think that level of focus is why a lot of startups do when focus is really important.
Keeps coming back to focus.
Yes. You gotta focus.
Yes.
And that's why don't get sucked into the AI hype. Only do it if it actually helps your business. From a building perspective, do whatever you have to do to get your first term sheets. We both obviously know a lot of people in that, a lot of founders. I know a lot of people that have not made it through this kind of, downturn, failed startups. I don't know if you have the same as well.
Yep.
What are some of the common mistakes that you've seen that these businesses have made?
I mean, definitely like, I don't know that it was a mistake, but like the metric totally changed. So it just used to be, I remember it was over 5 years ago now that one of my investors was a very seasoned investor was like, I have never seen a CEO have so much runway as you feel like you need to keep. Like, you don't have to keep over a year of runway, Sarah. Like, that's too conservative. And now all the advice is like, you need to have over 2 years of runway and you should be profitable and control your destiny. So, like, I think it was almost by accident, like, because I was so conservative about runway that we still exist today. If you were actually following best practices, like, you don't keep more than 18 months of runway. Ever, because then you're not growing fast enough.
Of course.
So I'm not surprised that all these businesses that were following best practices just kind of found themselves caught in the wrong stage for what was being funded. So that doesn't really feel like their fault.
So you think that it's not their fault at all and they had great businesses and they just couldn't raise more money?
I mean, there's a lot of things that out there that got funded that weren't such great businesses and got funded at the wrong valuation. But there were also some that just kind of got caught and got caught at a time where you couldn't bridge and like they're in the wrong stage where nothing in that stage is getting funded, even though they were kind of doing everything well or fairly well that any other market they would have at least found a bridge. I also think like it's been so so turbulent. Like, we had COVID, which either shut businesses down or grew them way beyond. Like, if you were an online business, you kind of grew way beyond what you were meant to be an offline business, like a co-working space. You basically shriveled up into nothing. And so you got this like extreme event. And then just as we're kind of like recovering from that, we're into this recessionary period where businesses aren't getting funded. So there kind of was no normal. It was hard to find like a steady business during that time. So it's like there's so many reasons why you could be dead that actually didn't have to do with this recession, but maybe you got hit really hard by COVID. And then as you're trying to recover from that, you're hit by there's no more funding.
Yeah, I think that definitely there's a lot of businesses that should have prevailed and they just got caught. But I think there's also a lot of the businesses that were not being run very well, that kind of like this recessionary like venture environment really showcased that. So I think that like lessons that I've learned before, like that literally kill companies, and the why people don't understand it is beyond me. Like, raising too much money at too high valuation will fucking kill you. The stakes are too high. What if you don't meet your growth targets? Your investors will stop caring, and then you're just gonna have a pile of money in your bank account that you can't actually like properly deploy, and you should be giving the money back.
I mean, yes and no. Like, we, so Series A, like what you're supposed to be at, like 1 million ARR. Now you probably have to be well beyond that because the metrics have shifted. But like, we raised our Series A back in 2019.
Yeah.
And we were pretty much no revenue.
Right.
So like, we were way, our quote valuation was way above like any kind of reasonable multiple, you know, 100x or something even wilder. Because we were sort of like pre-revenue, and we found investors who just were really aligned with our vision and what we were building, which, by the way, has changed drastically.
I think Series A is okay. It's okay if it's overfunded, like a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think like the key thing is like come into it with not such a naive mindset. If you know you're going into it and you're way overfunded for what you're worth because they're investing in you, or it's AI, or it's a hype thing, like, put that money aside and do not touch it. Like, you can do this. And
I don't think it's possible.
It is possible. Like, we didn't touch a bunch of money that like our investors were pressuring us to touch and grow and hire executives. And like, we still, to this day, we have a VP of engineering. Me and my co-founder, we have a really strong team with some amazing folks who, you know, probably would be executives anywhere else, but like, we don't call them that. That's just not what we've done. And like, we just were not willing to hire these people that have to come with massive titles and massive salaries. And like, we just said no. And I still to this day will get emails like once a month from investors being like, you should hire this person. They're amazing. They're on the market. And then I'll say no. And then they'll say, why not? And like, we have to do a whole back and forth rigmarole. Right. And it takes my time, but I still didn't make that hire. And like, we have more money in the bank because of it. Like, you do not, your investors are not running your business. So you don't have to listen to them. And I think a lot of people think you do. You absolutely do not. Like, your board could potentially fire you, but that's it. You don't have to listen to them. Just get yourself fired then. Don't do the thing that's going to put your business out of business. That's not your job as a CEO. And also, like, you do not have to stick to the thing you raised on. And we pivoted.
Yeah,
you know, we were starting as a parenting product. We built this whole community. We had an investor that led around because they really wanted the community. They were very sad when we shut down our community and we pivoted into childcare.
Yeah.
They still ask about it. And like, sorry, like, you're not running this company. You can place other bets in communities if you think that's going to be the next big thing. We're not doing that.
I think you're a lot more strong-willed than most people, because I think that not only do people fall into the pressure from investors, but even the pressure that other startups, especially in their area, they're the competitors. Like if they're raising big rounds and hiring big teams, like it, that's really hard to hold back and not do that, because you think that they're doing, like, yeah, this is just the common thing. And that's why I do say raise the amount of money that you think that you can, like, 10x your valuation for, like, the next round, realistically. And you should not be raising more than that. And just be, because if you do, and yeah, sometimes you get the opportunity to. And maybe you're the first person that I've actually ever heard that it sounds like it turned out right, and you just may be more disciplined than others. But there's just so many companies that will use that capital, they'll hire big teams, they don't have product market fit, and then all of a sudden, like, they're just like, there's no growth, and then they're like, what the fuck are we gonna do? And then so maybe the CEO probably is going to get booted out, obviously. And then it's just like, well, if you didn't take all of that, if you just took the next step. And also, I think that having less money, I don't know, it just it just forces you to be more creative.
I also look at it as like just life advice. Live way below your means. Like, I have always lived, I think, below my mean, in terms of, like, I don't wear fancy clothes. I don't buy fancy things. I don't drive fancy cars. Like, I am flying on a red eye in, like, jet blue coach. You know, it's going to be painful, but, like, those are below my means. And that doesn't mean, like, you can never spend your money on a rainy day. And I certainly do on things that are important. But if you do raise more money than you need, put it away. Live below your means. Run your company below your means.
Yeah.
Pretend like you didn't raise it. It is possible. Like, people don't live their lives spending every cent they make. They put it away and they save it for a rainy day. And then they're going to be really happy that they had it. And even if you never need that rainy day, it will help you to have that bank account when you're raising your next round or when you're going to sell your company. If you can say, I have $10 million in the bank, so you're buying my company and you're buying $10 million, like, that is really, really helpful. Like, that will only get you a better price.
Okay, let me ask you something. If you had an AI company and you raised, like, whatever, $100 million at, like, $1 billion valuation or whatever crazy amounts, what would you do given the competitive nature of this market right now?
I would spend the amount that I should have raised. So, like, I would treat it as if, like, okay, if I were going out and raising a Series B today, I'd probably raise $15 million, $20 million. Like, that's the amount of that $100 million that I want to.
But also knowing that you may not get that, because VCs want to see that the founders are extremely ambitious and they really wanted to win a market. And
Right. But I'm saying, like, if you were to raise $100 million, but you were only meant to raise $15 million, like, only plan on spending the 15 then, and, like, to get to that next stage, like, don't spend the 100. But you're competitive.
They're hiring so many people, and they're buying GPUs and they're buying all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't build, like, an AI infra company.
I think it's tough, and also from an investor's perspective, they want to see that the founders are super ambitious. Like, they don't want to go and be like, we're talking to founders here, like, but investors have a completely different, like, set of standards that they want. They want somebody who's going to be aggressive, that they want to own the market. They also, investors see, like, the one thing that they have the most influence over is, like, the amount of capital they have, which means you hire more people, which in their eyes means you're going to go faster. And so, like, you definitely do need to, like, at least play that game, if not actually do it. Like, I would say if I was in an AI infrastructure company, I thought I had product market fit, I would spend all that money. Like, I definitely would. Just because I know that there's only going to be one out of whatever. I would never build a company in the hype cycle again, so I wouldn't do that. But, like, I would be that aggressive because I know, like, there's only going to be one out of, like, the thousands of companies in that space.
Yeah, I mean, I would look at what is your moat. Like, if it's getting all the customers now, then yeah, you're going to spend it on sales and marketing. If it's perfecting the technology faster and better than everyone
more
else,
engineers.
Then it's engineers. So like, I would invest in the moat for us. Like, our moat was never sales. And yeah, we saw other childcare marketplaces go right out and spend all of their millions that they raised on salespeople. And we were like, that's not a moat.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that.
That's a good
point. We're
going
to spend ours on engineering, build the platform, build the data. And like, I think that was the right move. So we did have to spend, but it not the same as on, you know, all the sales outreach that was very expensive. If brand is your moat, then you spend on, you know, building a brand, and maybe that is more marketing. So I think that's what I would consider, but you probably never need to spend as much as you raised. Like, if you raised over your valuation, you have to put some of that aside and just pretend you didn't raise it, and like, just figure out how to do it smarter and better than your competitors. Like, ultimately, that's how you win.
Yep, that's true. Well, why don't we end it on that? I think we're at time. Good episode, Sarah. I look forward to hearing your AI pitch.
May.
Thanks for everybody for listening, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.